Welcome to 3GT, a podcast where a pastor, parishioner, and professor have lively conversations on practical Christian living from a Reformed perspective. For more information, visit our website at 3GT.fm.
Welcome back to another episode of 3GT. My name is Aaron Sams. I'm here with Kyle Borg and Barry York, your usual hosts for Three Guys Theologizing. Today, we want to do a little bit of a rewind episode. We've been throwing a lot of really diverse topics at our listeners for the last few weeks, and we've had some comments on our website and through email, and we want to go back through some of those questions, some of those comments, and further expound on some of the topics we've talked about and hopefully clarify a few of our positions on some of these things, some of the positions that not all three of us actually agree on. And we'll tease a few of those things out and hopefully clarify our positions and answer some of the questions. So the first thing I do want to talk about is our episode that we had on thievery, on taking something that is not yours. We had a comment on one of the websites that 3GT has posted on. It was about copyright law. And the comment was something along the effect of when an artist or when an author has written something, in ages past, someone has been able to build upon the work of someone who has written or produced something before them. But modern copyright law does not allow us to build upon the work of the people before us unless we cite it very specifically, and anything we would build upon them could in fact actually be considered a derivative work. And as somebody myself who has done some publishing in the past and has had derivative work clauses in his contract, I'm very familiar with this topic. And the question was, you know, is that a biblical concept, or is this is something that, you know, we've just kind of concocted? Is it just simply the law of the land and we have to go through with it? So guys, I'd like to open our conversation with that. But before I open our open discussion, I want to talk a little bit about this idea of a derivative work. So for those of you who don't know, and I'm not a lawyer, so this is not legal advice, we'll put that disclaimer out there. A derivative work is something that you develop that is based upon a previous work. So for example, I have a book out there and I created a derivative work, which is a workbook or a companion book that goes along with that original work. So it's aligned with, it's derived from the original work, but it is a separate document. Now, it happens to be published by my original publisher, and because my publisher actually owns the copyright currently to that particular work, if the book goes out of print, I take the copyright back, but I have simply signed it off to my publisher, and other derivative works have to go through them. Now, recently, I actually renegotiated that contract, and I got the rights for derivative works back from my publisher. So I can actually do anything that I want with the information in that original work, and I can produce other things with it. Specifically, I can sell it to be translated into another language, and that's what I was getting that right back. But guys, my question is, you know, I have contracts, I have an attorney who reads all of this stuff. It is the law of the land, but is there any biblical precedent for this idea of copyright and not using other people's work? You know, is there a biblical precedent? Is there an ethical thing we should be considering, or is it just simply we live in a world that has copyright laws and we have to abide by them?
Well, the fact that it is a civil law, as Christians, we should pay attention to. In 1 Peter, we're told to be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. So whether the law reflects accurately enough or not biblical principles, the fact that it's still a civil law in itself is something that we as Christians should pay attention to. So I do think we need to to honor these as far as we can. And this issue comes up in lots of different areas. I was listening to two men who make their living on YouTube, and one of the problems that they've denoted as, they call it freebooting, is when they produce an original YouTube video and put it up, and then somebody else takes a significantly long clip out of their YouTube video and basically builds their own video around it, maybe playing some music around it or making a narrative based on that particular video. Or there's even been teachers who will take somebody else's YouTube video explaining a scientific principle, and they'll lecture a little bit, show themselves lecturing a little bit in class, and then basically play the whole video and then come back at the end. And that, if you are getting your living off YouTube, that's really in a sense taking from them. And so these kinds of things are coming up, particularly through the digital world, all the time. And I do think we need to really pay attention to the laws. Like you, I remember you in our episode covering that, were really urging that upon us.
Kyle, any thoughts along those lines?
I agree with Barry. Even if, you know, I don't know the history of copyright laws. Some people have claimed that it's a bit of a modern phenomena. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe the way we have it iterated these days, it is more modern. I was just trying to scrounge around here recently. If I remember correctly, when the Westminster Assembly finalized the Westminster Confession of Faith in 1645, there was something very akin to a copyright put on that, where that could not be published and distributed by anybody for any particular reason, partly because of the fact that this body had met and they wanted to help control the distribution. So are copyrights a modern phenomenon? I don't know. I do think it's a civil law, and I think it's an area where the civil government has the right and the freedom to govern that, right? We tie it back to the Eighth Commandment. And the civil magistrate is to enforce the Eighth Commandment as far as it concerns his office. And though he can't govern the heart, he can institute these outward ways to protect the defrauding of people from property that is theirs. Would the Bible recognize that mental thoughts and images and things like that fall under property? I don't know if I could speak definitively to that, but our courts and our government has defined that as lawful property rights. And as Christians, we should believe in the rights to property. We're not communists. We don't believe anything is up for a free-for-all. We're not socialists. We believe in the right of people to have private property. And so for me, you know, if you said it in the, maybe that broader context, I think there are biblical principles that we can draw from, whether or not our exact copyright laws today have a one-to-one correlation with what the Bible might teach. Maybe that's stretching it, but I do think there are relevant principles by which we can conclude that this is a principle of justice. And it certainly doesn't go against what the Bible teaches.
And it's so easy to slip into this. I mean, even Kyle just now, did you notice he had to go and give a reference to the Westminster Confession and sort of a reference, probably should listen to a different podcast, another podcast. See how easy it is just to slip those things in?
Brought to you by the Jerusalem Chamber.
No, and it is easier now. I mean, with the access we have to information, it's far easier to simply copy and paste or copy and recreate or copy and build upon than it has ever been before. So I think that's partly why this is such a pertinent topic now, is it's much easier to violate those things now. And since it's so easy, we kind of blow it off as, well, it's not that big a deal. If I can just, you know, highlight some text, copy and paste it, like, clearly it's not that important if it's that easy. I mean, in the days past, you would have had to, like, go to a library, find a book, read a book, acquire the text that you need, write it down, rewrite it in something else, print it, republish it. I mean, seriously, the process to actually poach somebody else's work was far more difficult, and your chances of being caught were just minuscule compared to what they are now. Now that we have, you know, plagiarism checkers and search engines and things like that, it's easier to copy. It's easier to, you know, to find violations thereof and so on. That's, you know, I think it's a challenge, and I think that's why it's worth talking about. But I think as long as it's the law of the land, we need to abide by the law, mm-hmm. you know, and just be careful with that. So good. All right. So guys, another email that we got, and this was a comment about our episode that we had on tithing. And so I'm going to stand here a bit vindicated by the fact that our email said that neither of you guys fully addressed my question about whether or not electronic giving is appropriate. So I don't carry cash. The only checks I generally write are to the church to give. Most of the transactions I carry out are either using my credit or debit card or using my phone in some way, shape, or form. So there are churches out there who have giving apps, and you can simply pull out your phone and you can give. And I'm going to admit that since we recorded that episode, I have actually gone to a church. I have installed the app ahead of time, and during the time in which the offering plate is passed, I pulled out my phone and I gave to the church using their giving app during that time. Now, Barry, you expressed a concern about people having their electronic devices out during the church service. Now, I need to let you know, the only time I took my phone out was to give, and then I used the app, I gave the money, and I put it back in my pocket. That's the only time it was out. But is that legitimate? Is that still, you know, participating in the giving, you know, during that process of the worship service? And is the electronic app appropriate? And Barry, what's your deal with electronic devices in church? I kind of want to know more about that.
Real quick, before we hear from Barry, I just want to point out to our listeners, Aaron must be a transformationalist because he is redeeming every cellular telecommunication device.
Absolutely.
Good job, Aaron. I'm not a transformationalist, but good work. So let's hear from Barry.
Oh man, I think it's just I'm a Luddite. I'm an old guy. I still struggle with
a Luddite who carries an iPhone. I'll point out
I do use an iPhone in appropriate places. I turn it off. Like I don't
and
use
he
it.
Even has
I,
bit
I don't
emojis.
Turn it on during a movie at a theater because they tell you not to turn them on during the movie. And I still struggle with them in a worship service. And here's why. I was actually telling a class, without even thinking about this question coming up today, a class on worship the other day, is, you know, when I open my Bible in the service, my printed Bible, that's all it is. It's just a Bible. And I can't text with it. I can't receive a message. I can't send an email. I can't watch a video. I can't be distracted with it. And so when I open my printed Bible, there's a purity there that I am just so thankful for. And maybe it's just my mind, but when I open my phone up, it is a place of distraction. And I not only think about my calendar and, you know, if I've got my Bible on there, I'm not only thinking about my Bible, but I'm thinking about my calendar, text messages, emails, all the other things I use my phone to do. And some of the simplicity and the purity of what I think of when it comes to worship is just missing. I was reading an article this week about the impact of laptops in the classroom, and studies show that students don't.
Uh-oh. Wait. Which study? What were they studying?
Boy. I'll send
That's
you
a
link.
Episode right there.
I'll send you a link.
I know. I read the article. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, do you agree with it? Or I mean,
Aaron doesn't agree with any scientific studies.
That's not
Especially
true.
On Facebook.
That that particular article was talking about laptops during lectures. I haven't given a lecture in like 8 years, and so I don't worry about it too much. In fact, the work I have my students do during class time requires the use of a laptop. So I look at that article and I say, okay, if people are lecturing, yes, the device could be distracting. And that particular study showed that during a lecture, laptops are more harm than they are good. So I will grant them that.
Well,
okay.
Flipping the classroom.
Yeah, my
self-promotion.
My educational philosophy is notwithstanding, Barry, I have a question regarding the distraction thing. So I would agree with you. Yes, phones are more distracting. Notifications, pop-ups, all the different things that I could look at other than just the Bible app on my phone, which I have used in a church service and rather disciplinedly. Yes, you know, I can just use the Bible app, but all the text messages that are popping up, you know, in the meantime, yes, those are distracting. I will grant you that. But when I was a kid, I would sit in church during a long sermon that I didn't understand and was kind of bored listening to, and there were maps in the back of my Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I absolutely love in this life is maps. My wife loves maps. We have this gigantic National Geographic Atlas that my children love to pull out onto the floor. And especially when I'm out of town, they pull that out and they figure out where I am and they look at it in the Atlas app. So those maps were just as distracting as my cell phone is to me now as an adult during church. So, I mean, are we talking about electronics, or are we talking about just things that can draw our attention away from the focus of worship? I don't bring that up to be cheeky, but I bring that up to say that there are things out there that can draw our attention away. So, you know, is it a function of just we are distractible people and we need to find ways to focus, or do we need to like really truly avoid distractible things during a worship service?
I do think we have
to make the Bible simple again.
I do think we have to be careful about any type of imagery, idolatry, things that can distract us. And it's you know, again, the studies show that the phones are not only just a distraction in and of themselves, but they're actually, you know, if you've read Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, the plasticity of our minds are being rewired and shaped, and they're very addictive in nature. And so they're pulling on us. Sometimes we're not even aware of how much they're pulling on us when we have them in our pockets or when we're holding them in our hands. I know that. I have to have times in my day where I just put the thing away so that I can truly engage in, whether it's work or with my family or some other activity that I'm in, so that it's not distracting me. So in a worship service, I just think that there is a sense in which we are to make sure that we are separating ourselves from the world and worshiping the Lord. Now, I'm not saying per se that just having a smartphone in your pocket during worship is sinful or using an app. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that we really should be thinking clearly about this before we just say, well, sure, that's what we do every other day of the week and every other time of the week, so why not in worship? I think in worship we need to really think about how things are influencing us and what their effect on our hearts are.
Yeah, I agree, Barry. That's very, very wise, I think, advice, and very insightful to the nature of the cell phone. However, I also want to, you know, you said we have to be deliberate, we have to be intentional, we have to be careful. If I intentionally pull out my phone to give to the church during the time of giving, because that is how I transact the majority of my financial transactions, I mean, is that okay? Is that appropriate? And can I do that in good conscience? Like, I have no problem with that. And I guess my question is, like, if we want to avoid all distractions, then, you know, I mean, are there less distracting ways to give? Or is since this is how financial transactions are conducted a lot in our society, is it okay to, you know, pull it out and use it for that thing, as much as like, oh no, I forgot to write the check before I got to church, grab checkbook, grab pen, get distracted, write the check and throw it in there? I guess I'm looking at that thinking, okay, I agree that our smartphones, our digital devices are distracting and can be very much so, but if that's just like the way things go, you know, it's like if my shoe is untied in the middle of church. Okay, yeah, boot. If I wore boots, I would never have an untied shoe. But guess what? Most of the footwear that we buy in this world has laces. And if my shoe's untied, I'm going to stop. I'm going to get distracted. I'm going to tie it. I mean, is that analogous or am I kind of left field here?
I don't.
It's a horrible analogy.
Okay, fine. It's a horrible analogy.
No, one of the things that you said I believe is key is you talked about your conscience. And so I do think if a church, you know, if the leadership of the church has set it up so the people can give that way and you participate in that, then I'm not going to bind your conscience and say you can't do that, especially if you're having forethought and doing it. It would be an interesting discussion. Our session hasn't had that discussion. It would be a very interesting discussion to have to see what people think. As I admitted, I may be just a Luddite in this thing. I might have to get to come to the time that we're in now, but there's just still something, I don't know, there's just still something different from pushing a button than placing in the plate. But again, it's just probably my own sense of tradition and what I'm comfortable with.
All right, so guys, there's one other topic that came in over the last few weeks/months, and Kyle, this is going to be particularly pertinent to you and to me, I think. I lied, we have two more topics. So the first one is this of food fads, and we have come back to this a couple of times, and yes, I went on a bit of a rant.
A bit is an understatement.
I went on a big old rant in our discussion of food fads about being gluten free, and I stand by my statements. I'm not going to retract any of them. But, Kyle, it's come to my attention through you posting something on Facebook that you are on a keto diet now.
Not Facebook. I posted it on Instagram.
Oh, sorry. It was Instagram.
Let's get our social media platform correct. And I did it.
For the record, Instagram is owned by Facebook.
I did it during my sermon because I bring my phone to the... No, I don't bring my phone to the pulpit. So.
You're tweeting as you preach.
That's right. That was a good quote, Kyle. Let me quote myself.
So what is a keto diet? I don't have any idea.
Yeah, you know, I'm 84 days in and I'm not sure I have an idea either. No. So the keto diet is a manly diet.
A manly diet.
Basically, short and sweet of the ketogenic diet is it's not recommended very much for women due to certain issues. But what it is you basically train your body to use your fat stores for energy. And you do that by minimizing your carb intake to 20 grams a day. But then you can have up to 186 grams in my plan of healthy fats and about half that of proteins. And so what you do is your body naturally burns glucose for energy, and you deplete your body of all of its glucose so that it turns to your fat stores. And is a good way to drive down your BMI, and it's a good way to just lose some extra weight.
So in 1996, that was called the Atkins diet.
No, this is different. This is very... The ketogenic diet was invented in the 1920s to help children with epilepsy. The Atkins diet is a low-carb diet, but the Atkins slowly reintroduces healthy carbs. From my understanding, I've never done the Atkins, but from my understanding, you go through a period where you're very low carb, but the point of Atkins is to reintroduce that into your diet, whereas the ketogenic diet is just straight up low carbs the entire time. So,
okay. So I saw an interesting thing after
I forgive you.
What's that?
I forgive you.
Oh, thank you. My mistake. I saw an interesting, I'm trying to think what it was. Oh, I was listening to Freakonomics podcast shortly after we did that episode on diets, and they were talking about why the gluten-free craze exploded when it did. Like, why did it catch on so much? And a lot of what they were saying was it kind of came on the heels of Atkins and all of this low-carb craze. And then it kind of came on the increasing diagnosis of legitimate celiac disease of people who, you know, absolutely need to, you know, cut out gluten, and that kind of the combination thereof, along with gluten-free, along with some other healthy diets, it just kind of coalesced into this big movement that it was just kind of, you know, everything aligned at the right time, and it kind of exploded into the thing that it did. So all of that to say, we had some questions about that episode, and Kyle, I think you got some feedback, and Barry, can you remind me what some of the questions we had about our fad diet episodes were?
Well, I think they were just angry at you.
That's fine. It wouldn't be the first time people are angry at me.
Rightly so.
So tell me something I don't already know.
One of the things that has come up as a result, and some things that people have talked about, are churches switching to gluten-free communion bread for the Lord's Supper. You know, I think it was the Roman Catholic Church recently announced that gluten-free bread cannot be a part of the Mass.
Really?
It cannot be transubstantiated. You need a percentage of gluten, but obviously as Protestants, among the many other things we disagree with about the Mass, we would disagree at that point. But you know, one of the questions is, how does some of this health craze stuff affect the church? Should churches be sensitive to those things? That's at least one question I heard come out of it.
Got it. Yeah, no, that's good. So, I mean, I've been a part of churches in recent and past history that have done one of two things. Either have had a separate, you know, separate loaf, if you will, if you can make a gluten-free thing into a loaf, a separate bread for those who need something gluten-free, but then you have a separate bread in that case, or have just simply gone to gluten-free bread for the entire congregation for the Lord's Supper, just to accommodate that thing, because I've not heard of any situation until you just said that about the Roman Catholic Church that you know, the gluten is required. But now I've, on the other side of that too, with the cup, I've been in churches where, you know, they would have wine, but then they would also have juice for those whose conscience would not allow them. Or then there's just, you know, we're just going to do juice so we don't bind anyone's conscience. Or then there's the other side where we're only going to do wine, but then if you don't want to consume any alcohol, you're kind of stuck. But then there's also a situation at the church I was in Colorado Springs where they serve de-alcoholized wine. So it had been fermented, but the alcohol had been removed. So there are so many different options we can have here. What do you guys think about accommodation here? Because I've kind of seen the spectrum.
Our church, because it's kind of just a quick comment, our church does all gluten-free bread. We have people in our congregation with celiacs. We have people in our congregation who can't digest gluten. And so I think it was about 4 years ago, we made the decision that we were just going to go gluten-free.
Hmm. Wow. So our session, actually just last night, this issue came up. And so next session meeting, we're supposed to have a lot of bread, gluten-free bread, brought in as samples, and we're supposed to choose one. And some of the guys did ask, there is juice used, and they started asking if there was going to be wine served with the bread. I guess we're going from a split cup. Now we have a split loaf or
split loaf. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, at least you're
having a bread tasting. I used to do wine tastings when I was a deacon in the URC. We had to choose the communion wine. So we'd buy a few bottles, we'd have a tasting and choose the next case. So.
Well, I think the most important thing about the Lord's Supper, of course, is it's representing our Lord and our union with him. That's why we're eating his flesh and taking the bread and drinking of his blood and drinking the wine. But we need to make sure that whatever we're doing as a congregation to try to open up the table's access to perhaps more people is that we're still preserving the unity that table represents. So I think it's It's one thing to talk about this on a podcast, but it's a whole different thing to introduce these types of things into a congregation. Just like I still struggle with giving electronically because that's my tradition. People get really accustomed to communion being served a certain way. And that doesn't mean that we shouldn't make changes when it's helpful to the church. But I've found that if you're going to make those changes, there's a lot of pastoral work that has to be done to get people ready for that and to help them to understand why you're making those changes.
Good. All right, guys. So our last topic now is on our episode on heresy. There were names named during that episode, but some people thought that we picked the low-hanging fruit. We called out the easy heretics, and we did not go for any of the little, sub heretics or lesser heretics. So I guess the question that I have with that is, who gets to decide who's a heretic? You know, you kind of hear people throwing that term around a bit loosely sometimes, especially in online circles. Okay, a lot loosely in some online circles. And I think we were pretty careful in kind of picking the low-hanging fruit because we didn't want to go after anyone unnecessarily. Because, I mean, that's a pretty stark accusation. I mean, that's a bold thing to call somebody. You don't want to just toss that around like, hey, dude, hey, heretic, that's not in the same category. But so how are heretics actually defined? Who gets to pick? Who gets to decide who's a heretic?
So call me inconsistent.
You're inconsistent.
Okay, there
that's
we go.
To be called
that's
a heretic.
The end of my comment. So that's true.
No.
Part of this, again, goes back, and we'll let people re-listen to the episode, but how you define a heretic. But a heretic is not a name to throw around glibly, like, you disagree with me on something, so our disagreement or your error automatically means you're a heretic. Mm. Heretic is a word that really packs a punch in the sense that I think it is really almost synonymous with being cut off from the church. And so we did name some names because I think there are some people whose fruits are so evident that you can say with confidence, this person is a wolf and they are a heretic. But by and large, the reason we didn't, we picked the low-hanging fruit in some people's eyes is I think that we would agree that it's the church that really discerns these things. It's not up to the court of public opinion. If people want their own private opinion, whatever, I guess in some degree they're entitled to that. But I'm not in the habit of going around declaring heretics where the church has not spoken, because I think that's the church has been given the power and the authority. And Jesus is very clear, what you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And we're not going to get into the Protestant interpretation of that. But I think the church speaks to that. And like I said, there are some people whose fruits I think are so manifest, it's obvious. That is the low hanging fruit. So
I just go to Twitter and see what people say. And that's how I determine. No, I agree with what Kyle's saying is that we've really got to, if something is of enough danger that it's threatening the church, then the church needs to, the elders of the church need to make a declaration. That can be done locally. Sometimes there are men in a community that won't be known widely but are spreading things around, and so a session needs to warn a congregation about a local minister. But when they're more of a national type figure or widespread teachings, then I think it's really imperative for presbyteries and synods to take these teachings and reveal them for what they truly are.
All right. Well, guys, that's helpful to clarify that. And hopefully this answers some of your questions that you had out there. In our comments and in our email, and continue to give us that feedback, as there's are times when we don't address particular topics as thoroughly as we should, or might leave something hanging because we need to move on because of time or because we get distracted by somebody's comments. So continue to give us comments, and you can do that at 3gt.fm. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. And we encourage you to subscribe and leave us a review if you find us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you find your podcasts. Well, this has been another episode of 3GT. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time.